You're listening to Air Schooner, listening that moves you. Hosted by Stacy Waite and Scott Winter.
She's Stacy Waite.
And he's Scott Winter. Today, we're going to be talking about traveling and travel writing. So I was going to start off the show today by sharing a little bit of my wild travels. You know, as a kid, I was the youngest of seven. We didn't really go anywhere. And one summer, we finally got the chance to go somewhere. We went to France. And I was about seven, so I'm with all my brothers and sisters and my family in this fancy French restaurant. And I have this little steak that I'm about to eat, and I yell out, "Daddy, I want ketchup!"
Nice.
And the whole place sort of looked at me like, "Oh, I'm not fancy enough to go to France, let's face it."
So the Canadian patches on your backpacks weren't good enough to hide your Americanness.
No.
I guess I didn't really get to travel until I got into academia. And probably the coolest place it ever got me to was a nightclub in Pristina, Kosovo, where it was called a jazz club, but the owner came over to me and an older professor I was with to warn us that we may not like it, that it might be too wild for us. And we're like, "Jazz? Too wild?" And he said, "Well, you'll see." And what it happened to be was a Bulgarian punk band that did an incredible rendition of Gnarls Barkley's Crazy, but then went on to some kind of mix of Lionel Richie songs that they did in punk form, and it was amazing. Gee.
Hold on, I'm trying to imagine the song Stuck on You in a punk band form, Scott. I don't know if I can. I can't picture it.
I think it was more Lady, but I'm not sure. So we got to talk to travel writer Stephanie Elizondo Grice, who may have found herself in a much more interesting nightclub.
I'm in Havana. It's 2 p.m. on a Tuesday, and we're going nightclubbing because sometimes that's what you do, 2 p.m. on a Tuesday in Havana. With that, we jetted off to a nightclub called La Loipa, where a swarm of locals and backpackers had formed around a seven-piece band, playing the bata, the bongo, and the conga drums, wooden boxes, wooden blocks, and tambourines. Their voices provided the harmony, either leading, following, or arguing with the percussion. This was classic Cuban rumba, not the rumba of Fred Astaire or the son of the Buena Vista Social Club, but the rumba, born in slavery and raised on the streets of poor black neighborhoods by musicians possessing little more than a cardboard box, a bottle, and a stick. The kind that derives from the verb rumbiar, which means to party and to have a good time. The kind traceable to the religious and ceremonial dances of Africa. As we watched, a beanpole of a man and a big-breasted, big-ass woman in gold stretch pants maneuvered to the circle center to perform the wawanko, a fiercely flirtatious dance in which a man strives to give his partner a vacunao, or a mighty pelvic thrust. In this rendition, they appear to be imitating a rooster and a hen. That rooster strutted about, puffing his feathers as he pleaded, while the big chick stood her ground with complete composure. But as the music began to escalate, she started swiveling her hips in a tantalizing way, the crowd rooting her on. And when those congas suddenly climaxed in a burst of sound, that rooster gave us penetrating vacunao. And then the crowd fanned out onto the dance floor as the band began another number. As I scanned the crowd, my eyes fell upon a woman who appeared to be 40 years old and weighed approximately 225 pounds. She swaddled her galactic ass in pink spandex and stuffed her papaya-shaped breasts into a polka-dot halter top. A bouffant of Raphael Mermaid hair spilled across her shoulders. The heavy lady's syncopated beat of the bata drum had caught her in a temporary trance. She was slumped in a chair, eyes shut, body still. But as the rhythm sped a notch or two, it called her feet to action. Her spiked heels began to pound the beat onto the floor beneath her chair, and the music worked its way through her tree trunk thighs toward her massive belly, across her breasts, and finally to her head, which started swaying. Suddenly, the music commanded her to stand, and undulating every muscle of her full frame, she gyrated toward the dance floor, and then she began to rumba. Her energy was palpably feminine, undeniably sensual. She was like a Frida Kahlo painting of a melon bursting. She was fertility. She was womanhood.
Wow, there's a lot going on in a language there, and obviously we could get caught up on the galactic ass and all that, but you just get a real full sense of place there.
You not only get a sense of place, but you get a really great sense of humor. Stephanie Elizondo Grice has mingled with the Russian mafia, polished propaganda in China, and danced with rumba queens in Cuba. These adventures inspired her award-winning memoirs, Around the Block, My Life in Moscow, Beijing, and Havana, Mexican Enough, My Life Between the Borderlines, and the guidebook 100 Places Every Woman Should Go. Greist won the 2007 Richard J. Margolis Award for Social Justice Reporting and edited the 2010 volume of Best Women's Travel Writing. And while that piece she just shared with us was a really funny piece, once we got to talking about her work and talking about travel writing, we actually stumbled upon some pretty serious issues in travel writing having to do with ethics and responsibility. Some people have been characterizing you as a particularly culturally relevant and interesting travel writer, and I wondered what your feelings are about that term travel writer, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, I love the history of travel writing. You know, it dates back to Herodotus and Thucydides, you know, back in 400 BC. And, you know, it's exciting to sort of see myself in this very, 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 very long lasting genre that goes to ancient Greece, that then travels through Rome, that travels through all times, that goes to the Victorian ladies that traveled with their parasols and wrote fabulous travel logs with titles like To Lake Taganyika in a Bath Chair, you know. so it is something special, I think, to be a part of this very, very, very long genre. Many of the writers that I most deeply admire are part of this genre, including, you know, Pico Iyer, Robin Davidson. I feel like it's something that's quite exciting to me, but I feel like it's also a form of writing that has tremendous ethical landmines. Whenever I'm in the act of doing travel writing, I feel like I'm constantly treading over very explosive territory. And so I feel like it's ethically very, very problematic, but it's problematic in really interesting ways. And so so I love the history of travel writing, but I get nervous about calling myself one sometimes because I realize that it comes with so many like heavy, heavy ethical issues that I personally battle with and struggle over.
You know, Scott, at first when she said that thing to me about our sources always being right, I was a little skeptical. I'm not gonna lie. And you know,
yeah.
I'm not a journalist, so I was, you know, learning as I was listening to her. But when she started talking about digging deep enough, if you dig deep enough, then you'll understand how someone's become who they become. I thought that was really interesting.
Well, Stacey, you might be a journalist because journalists are skeptical, but you're right on the second part too.
Yeah, I mean, I kept thinking about this book, A Chorus of Stones by Susan Griffin, where she basically, part of her project is she sets out to understand Heinrich Himmler, who is Hitler's right-hand man. And she really is trying to answer this question, like, how does someone become Hitler's right-hand man? And I think what Stephanie Elizondo Greist had to say about, you know, really trusting that people have become who they've become for a reason, and that part of her job is to figure out what those reasons are and to explore those reasons.
Yeah, I agree. And those principles are also true when you're trying to write about a place as a whole. A recent book that came out by Catherine Boo called Behind the Beautiful Forevers is about the Mumbai slums, right? And you can't just look at the Mumbai slums and describe what you see point blank. You have to get behind the story and get underneath the story, and that's what that book does. And, you know, when you read news reports, that's what you're getting. You're getting the veneer of a place.
Yeah. How do you get underneath the interview? That's the thing that always strikes me is like, how do you get to a place of getting underneath that?
I think it's all about the time you spend there. It's about the ethics that Stephanie's talking about. And it's about knowing how to network and find the right people who know what truth is. And one person who spent a lot of time in a place that's been written about a lot in the news lately is Daniel Wallace, who spent a lot of time in Syria.
Wow.
And yeah, Daniel was able to share with us a piece that he did about Syria. And Daniel's a British writer who until recently lived in Philadelphia. He studied and taught creative writing at Rutgers' Camden campus, and his fiction has been recognized in several writing contests, and his story, The Hills Will Melt Like Wax, is forthcoming at the Tampa Review. He's published essays on Saul Bellow and Stanley Fish in the Fiction Writers Review, and was the first place winner of the 2011 Tony Brown Scholarship for the Winter Getaway Writing Conference, and he maintains the literary personal blog on pinestreet.com. And this is Wallace reading from that recent essay that he's entitled Syria Before.
This year, we've seen so much horror come out of Syria. But when I was there, Back in 2007, the country was calm. I spent 8 months writing short stories, taking Arabic lessons, and hanging out in Damascus's ancient quarter with the European and American language students. Although on the streets of the old city, sullen young men sometimes tried to grope or hassle the foreign women, aside from those guys, Syrians were incredibly welcoming and generous. When I visited a tiny coastal town, the sun baking the plain concrete houses, the owner of a corner shop called to me and passed over a chilled Coca-Cola. He waved me on with a smile. Just a few blocks later, a car repair team was taking a break. They asked in Arabic if I would like to drink tea with them. This was just normal behavior in Syria. In Damascus, I got to know two teachers in the university, and I came in to talk to their students. The classroom contained the mix of cultures that so characterized the Syria I knew: Sunni Muslims, Alawi Muslims, Christians, Kurds. Some of these students were adamant about their faith, but many were not. Some women wore the headscarf, many did not. We were discussing everyone's career plans, when one guy said something sharply critical of the regime. Everyone froze. This guy, he had curly reddish hair and a kind of thin, quick, intellectual look. He saw how nervous he had made the room, and he laughed. "We can speak our minds here. No one's listening." I didn't know a great deal about Syria then. I still don't. But that day, it seemed like no one really knew what was permissible. Who knew what was too far? Everywhere in the city, you saw posters and murals of President Assad or his dead father, and they were usually dressed in uniform, staring coldly into the distance. Even during those outwardly peaceful days, the regime made no pretense. It offered national security and public order, nothing more. There was no hope for anything to be made better, not the economy, not improved international relations, not the rule of law. In the north of the country, a doctor told me, "We all hate America. We all want a green card." One evening, while I sat in a dingy, male-only tea house in the part of Damascus my Arabic teacher called Thieves Market, where second-hand goods of all kinds were sold, one of the students from the English class recognized me, came over, and asked for my help. He was a Christian in love with a Muslim. Her parents were very strict, however, and she no longer answered his calls. He thought that when I went back to England, I could call her, and my international phone number would be surprising enough for her to pick up. He said, "I just want to know how she feels." I refused. I guess I just didn't want to get involved, or I couldn't take seriously such a bizarre strategy. Then I left the country and went back to England. And now that Syria, the Syria I remember, is gone. Whether Assad survives or falls, how can the country find peace again, now that so many have pledged to stand by the killers, when so many have vowed to avenge the dead?
That's our show on travel writing for today. Please continue to join us every 2 weeks for upcoming Air Schooner episodes.
Thanks for listening.
Air Schooner is a bi-weekly product of Prairie Schooner and produced with research support from Robert Fugli, Ted Wheeler, and Marianne Kunkel. Production assistants are Catherine Larson and Franny Sprouls. Technical support comes from Rick Alloway of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's College of Journalism and Mass Communications. Air Schooner is produced by Scott Winter and the brainchild of executive producer Kwame Dawes.